Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, this is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by Abigail DeKosnick and Keith Feldman, who are editors of a fascinating new book, Hashtag Identity, Hashtagging Race, Gender, Sexuality, and Nation. This book was published in 2019 by the University of Michigan Press and is a fascinating compilation of a number of different perspectives of our understanding of the idea of identity as it connects to Twitter, activism, and a variety of different forms of identity and where those things intersect and also how they reach globally. But I'm going to let Gail and Keith tell us a little bit about that. First, I'd like to introduce Keith Feldman and Gail DeKosnick to the New Books Network and ask them each to tell us a little bit about themselves and how they came to this really interesting project.
Great. Well, my name is Abigail DeKosnick. Please call me Gail. And what happened to bring this project about is that I was talking to one of my graduate students. I'm a faculty member at UC Berkeley. And I was talking to my graduate student, Paige Johnson, who was then a PhD in performance studies and is now an assistant professor at Barnard. And Paige and I were just throwing around ideas about what's going on with new media studies. And we asked each other, is the color of new media studies white? In other words, so much of what we were reading about digital technology and social media seemed to focus on these great white inventors like Steve Jobs or Bill Gates. And we just wanted to know, where's the rest of the scholarly literature? Where's all the scholarship on women, on queer people, on people of color, on people outside of North America? And on a whim, we started a working group. We convened a meeting and announced it to the arts and humanities and social science parts of UC Berkeley and said, let's call this working group The Color of New Media. Let's investigate scholarship that asks questions about diversity and inclusivity and new media studies. And maybe we can also produce scholarship about those things. And at the first meeting, another faculty member, Keith Feldman, showed up. And I immediately asked him to be my co-faculty organizer of the working group, and Keith agreed. And so we just started meeting once a month as a working group. And I'll let Keith introduce himself right now, and then maybe we can both talk about how the book came about.
Yeah, so great. And thanks so much, Lily, for hosting this. So I'm Keith Feldman. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Ethnic Studies at UC Berkeley. And around about 2010, 2011, I started doing some work kind of as a cultural historian and a historian of race around the ways in which race was getting sort of worked and reworked in the context of the war on terror, and the ways in which sort of contemporary media technologies were being kind of used as platforms for thinking and rethinking about sort of the operations of race in the wider context of the national security state. I was doing it, doing this work pretty much in my own little bubble when all of a sudden I heard of the Color of New Media Working Group coming on board. And I jumped at the opportunity to go to this meeting. And the kind of the diversity of views, disciplinary backgrounds, areas of interest, all really kind of sparked my curiosity and really expanded the scope of my own research interests. So we met and almost immediately started thinking about what kind of work could we produce? What kind of work about new media studies could we create and get into the world? At a moment, you know, this was probably 5 years ago, when it was hard to find kind of work in new media studies that took kind of axes of social difference quite seriously.
And this book, which is really interesting in bringing those different axes together and looking at them in different perspectives, I would love for you both to talk a little bit about, you know, the sort of way that you thought about this project as it came together with its, you know, sort of title of hashtag identity, but also the distinction we have in terms of race, gender, sexuality, and nation.
Yeah, great. I just want to say quickly that I'm a faculty member. I'm an associate professor in two places, in the Berkeley Center for New Media and the Department of Theater, Dance, and Performance Studies. Keith is an associate professor in ethnic studies, and our students, our graduate students who participate in the working group, are from many more departments than the three units that Keith and I represent. So we attracted graduate students from our departments of ethnic studies, performance studies, new media, but also film, also rhetoric, comparative literature, gender and women's studies, African American studies, Asian American studies. We just started to have conversations that were very highly cross-disciplinary and ranged so far and wide. And what each of us were thinking about Twitter especially and social media more generally from all of our different backgrounds. And in our first couple of years, it just seemed like every working group meeting, somebody was bringing up a hashtag of the month. Black Lives Matter was just getting started at the time that our working group got started. So we talked about that a lot and all of the different social media and in-person movements that were part of Black Lives Matter and still are. And there was also a lot around popular culture, a lot around politics, a lot around how gender was being negotiated and performed online. And at a certain point, we just thought, I actually really remember this conversation where we just decided, you know what, Twitter's probably going away really soon. All social media platforms come to an end. You know, MySpace ended, Friendster ended, and Twitter's probably going down in a year or so, we said in like 2015. And so we sort of decided collectively to write what we thought would be Twitter's obituary. We thought we would write a book about all the hashtags we had discussed, and then maybe it would live as a kind of archive of this funny, idiosyncratic, short-lived social media site that people used in the 2010s. Of course, that's not what happened to Twitter. Twitter didn't go, didn't die a quiet death. Instead, the 2016 election happened and Twitter is more active than ever before. So we ended up creating a book that isn't an homage to a dead platform, but is instead, I think, lives as a kind of record of an important first you know, 5 years of Twitter as one of the most active political sites in the country and in the world. Keith?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that this book isn't overtly about, of course, is it's not about the rise of Donald Trump. It's not about sort of large-scale institutions and organizations utilizing Twitter as a platform. It's not about bots and so many of the sort of the permutations of sort of very contemporary current debates about the place of Twitter in the broader kind of U.S. political culture. It is a kind of a counter memory that prefigures Twitter as a platform for presidential proclamation, and in that way, I mean, one of the great insights that I got out of so many of our contributors' work is kind of the ways in which local embodied networked forms of kind of creative social movement seized on Twitter and utilized it and innovated through it different kind of forms of social justice activism, forms of identity construction and circulation. In the process, you know, Twitter was being marshaled and hashtagging, perhaps more generally, was being marshaled as a way to cohere and articulate forms of identity, often minoritarian forms of identity, in the face of things like white supremacy, heteropatriarchy, etc. And so there's kind of a through line in the book that's tracing the sort of the operations of minoritarian difference as they're getting worked out and performed on Twitter.
And that was part of what I was really interested in reading through your book. I did enjoy the part in the introduction where you talk about the thinking that this was going to be kind of an obituary for Twitter. And yet it turned out not to be so. But I would love to sort of take you through, if it's all right with both of you, the sections of the book, because there are four parts that are sort of focusing on different aspects of our understanding of how particularly Twitter and hashtagging is used. And then the final section, which is more conclusive and forward-looking, notes from the color of new media. But if you could just go through and talk a little bit about what's part of each section, part one, Black Twitter Futures, part two, mediated intersections, part three, disavowals, which I was really, really interested in my sort of academic interests in political science. Part four, Twitter International, which I also followed quite closely in following some of the Green Revolution in Iran and so forth. So can I ask you to each of you to talk a little bit about each section of the book and what your authors are doing in those sections and what their sort of analyses are and how they fit together?
Yeah, absolutely. Keith, do you have, would you like to take, we could alternate. Do you want to take part one or would you like me to take part one?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, why don't I take part one and then Gail, you can take part two. And we can go from there. Yeah, so part one is called Black Twitter Futures. And, you know, as Gail mentioned, the book project really began to come together in the context of the hashtag Black Lives Matter as a way of organizing political community, of rallying people to particular actions, of bringing attention to the spate of the deaths of Black men and women at the hands of the state. And you know, one of the things that this part really hones in on is the ways in which you know, hashtag Black Lives Matter is kind of one kind of large scale hashtag that we can think about. And there are sort of numerous other ways in which social media in general, Twitter in particular, and forms of hashtagging have been used to contest kind of different forms of anti-Black racist violence and gender violence. So the section opens with Malaika Imhotep's chapter on this amazing hashtag called On Fleek, this expression that comes from a platform that did have its kind of beginning and end called Vine. And here, Imhotep, who's a PhD student in African American studies at Berkeley, really hones in on how this kind of ephemeral moment of a young woman, Kayla Newman's self-expression of joy gets captured on Vine and then circulates super widely. You know, On Fleek gets taken up all over the internet and also all over kind of corporate American culture. And Imhotep does this really quite lovely kind of performative analysis of how the value of Black performance is both, you know, captured in these various moments, but then also exceeds those forms of capture. Paige Johnson, a co-founder of the working group, in the next chapter addresses street harassment and online harassment by looking at the hashtag UOCASIS and sees sort of how that particular hashtag gets used by African American cis and trans women to express forms of solidarity and to develop what she calls a techno-cultural assemblage to document violence in various kinds of ways. The next chapter is by Amina Norris and Nalia Rodriguez, who are looking at the social media work that happens in the aftermath of the death of Sandra Bland, whose death is now actually quite recently in the news again. And Norris and Rodriguez are looking at how different platforms and different engagements with the movement to hashtag say her name get taken up in different ways, right? So that Facebook and Twitter are actually, what they see is that Facebook and Twitter actually take up rather distinct engagements with thinking through what say her name means. Grace Gibson focuses her chapter on the hashtag Afrofuturism. And what Grace does in this chapter is does this really remarkable work to think about how online communities and real life communities are getting brought together around this particular hashtag. So to think about how the kind of consolidation of Afrofuturism as a field of scholarly interest and pedagogy gets worked out in various kinds of ways, including at things like academic conferences, community activists who are building tech-rich community centers, the sharing of syllabi and scholarly resources, etc. And then the chapter closes with a conversation that we had in the working group with Reverend Osagiefo Sekou, who came in the fall of 2015. Rev Sekou has a really wonderful and important background in organizing and activism on the ground, particularly in Ferguson. And he helps us think, I think, really carefully about what something like the hashtag Black Lives Matter enables, right? And one of the key things that it enables is the materialization of politics, of getting bodies in places, in communities. And at a time when so much political work seems diffuse and disconnected, especially in the sort of the contemporary neoliberal context, Reverend Sekou has us think really carefully about what it means to have bodies in place, that that's actually quite crucial to the kind of networking potential that something like a hashtag brings to bear.
Great. Gail, if you want to take us through the second part, mediated intersections, that would be fabulous.
Yeah, absolutely. So part two, mediated intersections, has four great essays in it that all look at how media, how hashtags act as their own kind of media, their own media format that brings to consciousness and sometimes brings into collective action minoritized groups of people. So the first essay in that section is by Lindsay Ogle. And it's that essay is called Confused Cats and Post-Feminist Performance. And Lindsay takes on this really tangled set of performances by women online, some of whom identify as feminists and others who identify as not feminist at all. And sometimes that group of women who disidentify with feminism are called post-feminists, which is in itself a confusing term. And then many so-called post-feminists are called confused by feminists because feminists say women who claim they're not feminists don't know what feminism means. They're just confused. And then Lindsay takes up the figure of some guy on Tumblr, somebody who started posting under this tag Confused Cats and was really posting about the sort of battle between feminists and post-feminists and sort of rendered that conflict as a confused cat fight, like as if all women are cat fighting and then they're confused about it. So he'd sort of post pictures of cats and then allude to these different hashtags that women on both sides of the feminism debate were using. And Lindsay is able to unpack that confusion and notes that a lot of women who very deliberately and intentionally proclaim themselves post-feminists on Twitter are actually using a lot of feminist discursive moves. Like they're using autobiography, they're talking about self-empowerment, they're declaiming their own uniqueness, their own individuality. And you know, these are feminist tactics. And she also is able to note how easily these perceived conflicts between women are taken up by misogynists as almost proof that women can't get it together. They can't find solidarity. They'll always be confused, you know? So it's a really interesting essay that reaches into a part of the way that women struggle with their own political identities and with one another's political identities online. The next essay in that section is called Hashtag Why I Stayed, and it's by Julia Havard. And the hashtag campaign Why I Stayed was founded by survivors of partner violence, of domestic violence. And it was that hashtag was populated by many, many survivors of partner violence, and most of them women. And what Julia is able to get to in that essay is to really dwell and linger on this very different tonality that characterized all the hashtags or all of the posts in this hashtag, Why I Stayed, because those survivors' autobiographical statements in Why I Stayed were about inaction. They were about staying still. They were about stasis and remaining in a threatening, violent, and potentially lethal domestic situation. And Julia writes this very poetic examination of the power of just reflecting on one's own stasis, one's own inability to move. And she makes this great case, these great set of arguments about how staying in situations of domestic violence is often about intractable obstacles, lacking financial resources, not having family to turn to, feeling like you're responsible for saving the one that you love, saving them from themselves, being the victim so that you can make them better. And then on the other hand, that the stories in Why I Stayed also were about preparing to leave. They were about the moment before, or the moments, the days, months, years before a survivor is ready to exit the situation. So sometimes staying is not just about immobility. It's also about preparation. It's also about finding resolve. It's also about amassing resources. So I find that to be a really moving and powerful essay that looks at a different kind of hashtag activism that doesn't look like activism to a lot of people, but really can be very powerful. The next essay in that section by Jose Ramon Lizarraga and Arturo Cortez is called Hashtag Gentrification. And that is a great essay on the drag performer Persia, who is a Latinx San Francisco performer. And Persia wrote a song called Google Google Apps Apps and directed and produced and performed in a tremendous, hilarious video for the song Google Google Apps Apps that anyone can find on YouTube that is a parody and critique of the tech industry taking over San Francisco. And the gentrification of San Francisco and Oakland by big tech has meant that there are fewer and fewer and fewer spaces for minoritarian groups. The group that Persia belongs to and is most concerned about is queer Latinx collectives. And Lizarraga and Cortez are able to argue that actually, even though there's this this displacement of queer Latinx spaces in the Bay Area, that Persia shows a way that that culture of what they call queer gestures can have a new life and a different life online. And they coined this phrase, digital queer gestures, to point to what Persia is doing in that video, that Persia is importing and virtualizing all of the ways of being and movements and language and performance styles, all the things that queer Latinx people used to be able to find in clubs and venues around San Francisco. She imports that into the online space, and people can still find community and collectivity in that other space, in that virtual space. The final essay in that section, Hashtag Television by Renee Pastel, is a terrific look at hashtags relating to two TV shows, RuPaul's Drag Race and Jane the Virgin. And Renee shows that the kinds of official hashtags that appear on screen when you're watching TV, like for RuPaul's Drag Race, you might see hashtag Drag Race in the lower right-hand corner of the screen when you're watching it. Networks would like viewers to participate in official hashtags, but Renee points out that actually it's on RuPaul's Drag Race, all of the best hashtags were made by the contestants themselves, like hashtag Vlazeta, hashtag purse first. And these were hashtaggable phrases that the contestants formulated to establish their own brands, to make them stand out from the rest. And they're the hashtags that viewers use the most when tweeting about Drag Race. Renee looks at a different set of hashtags with Jane the Virgin. She actually points out that the official hashtags of Jane the Virgin are often very political and are urging political action on the part of viewers. Like if there's an immigration storyline playing out in Jane the Virgin, there'll be hashtag vote, vote, vote on the screen in all capital letters. So the text is actually announcing the kind of political action it wants viewers to take on that show. And in both cases, Renee says, the shows find ways to encourage not just participation from viewers, but identification in really political ways. And this is one of the first essays I've read on what's called second screen viewing, the ways that we are used to having our phones or laptops out while watching a screen, like a television screen, and we're tweeting or using hashtags on Facebook at the same time that we're watching television play out before us. So Renee is doing a great job by analyzing the political potentials of second screen viewing in that essay.
And that's something that has become more and more prevalent as I've experienced it myself watching Scandal. And the request that, you know, you've got to tweet the show while you're watching it, as well as many of us political scientists who regularly tweet on election night as we're watching the returns come in. So the second screen experience is an interesting one. Parts three and four, and Gail, you have a chapter in part three, Cancel Colbert, or hashtag Cancel Colbert. And that section, again, is very, very prevalent in the news these days with regard to these questions of the use of Twitter by the alt-right and a variety of other groups in that regard. So if one of the two of you would talk a little bit about part three, disavowals.
Yeah, Gail, maybe you could take part three and I could take part four on Twitter International.
That sounds great. Okay, part three, disavowals, is about ways that people say no online. And what does that mean? It's about when people want to distance themselves from an ongoing hashtag campaign, or when they want to disavow some kind of identity that seems to be really popular online and offline. So it's about refusals and identifying oneself by stating that one is not a part of something. It's about not joining in. So the first essay in that is by Kyle Booten, and it's about the hashtag All Lives Matter. And Kyle does a great job using network analysis of identifying what is happening when people tweet hashtag All Lives Matter. And Kyle noticed using a data science project that All Lives Matter was often, most often appearing immediately after the hashtag Black Lives Matter in people's tweets. So he identifies the use of All Lives Matter as a corrective, a disavowal of Black Lives Matter. It's like, in other words, people say, yes, 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 Black Lives Matter. I know that this campaign against police violence against Black people is happening in this country, but what's more important is that all lives matter. And the way that that rhetoric ends up working on Twitter is that it seems to shut down the point that Black Lives Matter is trying to make. It seems to be saying that Black lives actually don't matter because all lives matter, because we should be colorblind, because we don't want to see race. We don't want to see racial difference. So Kyle really takes on that kind, what can seem like inclusive rhetoric, all lives matter, and demonstrates how silencing and oppositional and exclusive it is. The next essay is my own essay, #CancelColbert, which was a moment when Stephen Colbert's show's official Twitter account tweeted out a racially insensitive joke about Asian Americans. It turned out that Colbert himself had nothing to do with that account and didn't know who tweeted that out. It was probably some kind of intern. But the official account of his show tweeted a joke that was just the very tail end of a much longer joke that Stephen Colbert told on the show. So it sort of missed the context of a longer piece about, it was actually a joke about the Washington Redskins and how racist that sports team name is. And Colbert's joke to end it was something like, I'm going to start a foundation to support Orientals called Ching Chong, Ding Dong, Oriental, whatever. And so the official show account tweeted out just the Ching Chong, Ding Dong part. And immediately an Asian American online activist, Sui Park, and that's a pseudonym, Sui Park tweeted out #CancelColbert. Because it wasn't just that she was offended, it was that she felt that that move of using a racist joke, using racist humor to criticize racism is just a poor move. It just ends up reinforcing and strengthening racist discourse. So she is more critiquing the very concept of using anti-Asian racism to combat racism against indigenous people. You know, that to her, that was a kind of doubling down that she didn't agree with. And plenty of people sided with Sui Park, but plenty of people really hated the Cancel Colbert campaign. Pointed out how everybody who was tweeting Cancel Colbert was missing the whole point of irony and sarcasm. People were really outraged by the outrage in Cancel Colbert. And what I end up pointing out in the essay is that the Cancel Colbert and anti-Cancel Colbert campaigns really previewed how a lot of the November 2016 election was going to play out, because what we see with the rise of Trumpism is this kind of outrage against liberal politics, this sort of way that right-wingers stand up and say, I'm outraged that liberals are expressing these ideas. I'm going to take the risk of being different from them. I'm going to perform my political outrage online all over the place. And we see all of those moves made in what seems like a kind of, you know, not that important online conflict around Cancel Colbert, but it ended up foreshadowing a lot of moves that got made later by Trump himself, by Milo Yiannopoulos, by other spokespeople for the alt-right. In the third essay and the final essay in the section, #NoHomo, Bo Ruberg looks at how many tweets about admiration for male performers, for example, dancers or singers, how many of these admiration, you know, fanish tweets by what seemed to be male users of Twitter contain the #NoHomo. So why is it that when men express their fandom for other men, that they have to distance themselves from any hints that they might have homosexual, romantic, or physical attraction to these male performers? Why is #NoHomo so popular? And Bo demonstrates that homophobia is just rampant online, even in the most casual ways, even in tweets that seem kind of funny, like it's sort of humorous that people tweet hashtag no homo, but it's also this very pervasive homophobia that goes really unnoticed in everyday social media use.
Thanks. And I was not fully aware of that whole movement. And that chapter, I was really kind of flummoxed and concerned that this is so prevalent in such a, as you say, kind of a nonchalant kind of way. But all of these chapters in Disavowals I found to be really fascinating and helping to understand a lot of the kind of political dynamics on Twitter these days as well. The final section before we get to sort of the concluding essays is Twitter International. And Keith, you said you would take us through some of the chapters in that section.
Yeah, absolutely. So the final section is called Twitter International. One of the stories of the kind of the rise of hashtag activism and activism on Twitter, some of the most powerful and important stories are about the Iranian elections in 2009 and the Arab Spring in 2011. And one of the things that the book writ large attempts to do is to kind of bring those movements and moments into a conversation around questions of social difference in the United States, primarily. But at the end of the book, we kind of move back out into the global context or into the international context, and rather than look at Iran again or at the Arab Spring, we have authors looking at India, at the African continent, and at the UK. So the first chapter in this section is by Neha Kumar, and the title is Twitter for Celebrities Only? A Qualitative Study of Twitter Use in India. And Neha has the chapter is based on kind of a long ethnographic project where she's interviewing social media users, mostly younger people in India, for about 18 months. And one of the things that she reveals in these through this ethnography is that Twitter is actually a fairly narrow space for broad sort of democratic political culture, right? It's only a few people, celebrity types utilize Twitter as a platform for broadcasting. Now, a lot of people follow celebrities on Twitter, so a lot of people are reading what celebrities have to say. But the kind of engagement in political discourse isn't happening so much on Twitter. What she's finding is that other online communities, particularly in Facebook, Telegram, and WhatsApp, are more likely where sort of expressions of political agency and something like freedom are getting articulated and expressed. And she points to the ways in which these social media platforms allow a more kind of defined set of parameters for who's inside a conversation, right? There's kind of levels of privacy that one can generate that you simply don't have on Twitter. The next chapter is by Reginald Royston and Crystal Strong, called Reterritorializing Twitter: African Moments 2010 to 2015. And what Reggie and Crystal do in this chapter is they look at a couple different cases taking place on the African continent, particularly Ghana, Nigeria, and a bit in South Africa as well. And one of the things that they focus on is that Twitter and hashtags more broadly are getting used in quite local ways to raise awareness about local concerns. Right. So one example is the hashtag #dumpsore, which arises to protest Ghana's infrastructural breakdown. And the need for a certain kind of renewed investment in infrastructure in the country. And then they also look at a hashtag called Bring Back Our Girls that, you know, gained a wide prominence in the United States when First Lady Michelle Obama brought it to, you know, to the attention of the U.S. public. But Bring Back Our Girls, it was kind of articulated to local Nigerian activism that had very grounded and kind of embedded forms of political community at their back, right? So while we think perhaps of some forms of hashtag activism circulating quite broadly and crossing borders in a kind of smooth way, you know, Royston and Strong are very keen to have us think very carefully about the local material context. And they also are adamant and I think quite compelling in thinking about how the social media scape, what they term the social media scape in Africa, is a site of innovation, of creativity, of growth and transformation, and not just a site for the sort of the passive translation of, you know, Silicon Valley technologies. The next chapter is a co-authored piece by Navina Karusala, Trevor Perrier, and Neha Kumar called Hashtag If Africa Was a Bar, Participation on Twitter Across African Borders. And here the researchers look at basically a few days in 2015, when the hashtag If Africa Was a Bar was circulating quite widely on Twitter. And they grab about 2,300 tweets. And from that data set alone, start to reflect on, you know, what does it mean to be able to look at the different ways in which people are utilizing hashtag If Africa Was a Bar. And there are kind of two notable dimensions that I think kind of come through on the methodological level in this chapter. One is that you can begin to see the kind of the proliferation of folks from different countries engaging this hashtag, Ghana, Nigeria, Kenya, South Africa, as well as folks tweeting from outside the African continent. So you can see a kind of localized expression of identity. But then on the flip side of that, they're also interested in showing how this kind of research engaging kind of larger scale data sets on Twitter requires us to think about the outsider status of researchers, and that there's a way in which As outsiders, and the three of them are based in the United States, how they kind of create coherence, meaning, and effects of these hashtags in ways that might not necessarily be consonant with how they're getting articulated locally. And then the last chapter kind of brings the book full circle in a way. This is by Kimberly McNair, and it's called Beyond Hashtags, Black Twitter and Building Solidarity Across Borders. And what McNair does in the chapter is point out something that I was not at all familiar with when the book started, which was the kind of the transit of the hashtag Black Lives Matter beyond the United States. And across the African diaspora. And McNair looks in particular at the ways in which organizing against police violence in the United Kingdom began to articulate and interface with, you know, organizers in the Bay Area, in the United States, in Ferguson, in Southern California, and elsewhere. And there's a way in which the online organizing against police violence becomes a catalyst for offline interactions, right? So that part of the story that Kim tells in this chapter is of the organizers in the UK who have been organizing against police violence against Black people for several decades, since the 90s, how they're actually brought on a tour to California to meet with and interact with organizers in the States and to trade stories, to get to know one another, to strategize, to think about what works and what doesn't. In various contexts. So it really, in many respects, brings the book full circle.
And I wanted to ask, I mean, this is a really fascinating and complex and deep book. And I know it came out of this sort of monthly working group. But as authors were writing and you were receiving chapters and drafts of their work, I wanted to know, what were you each most surprised by in terms of what the research was indicating, what you were learning from the work that your many authors were doing?
Gosh, that's such a huge question.
I know. Just one thing.
We were, I think I can speak for Keith and myself when I say we were so amazingly impressed with what our graduate students produced. Just blown away. You know, some of these authors were very advanced in their graduate degrees or had even just recently graduated UC Berkeley with their doctorates. And they were, many of them are now already assistant professors, you know, starting their own faculty careers. But a good portion of our contributors, this is their first scholarly publication ever, you know. I mean, so many of these authors, this was the first thing they wrote that wasn't just going to be a graduate seminar paper. It was going to be a real brand new leading edge scholarship for publication. And that's what we asked them to do. That's what they set out to do. And they did it. What I think we love about the whole collection is just the sheer diversity of topics. You know, when we walk through, when each of us in the world experiences social media on a daily basis, we're basically only experiencing like 0.00001% of whatever's happening online. As Marshall McLuhan says, the the global telecommunications, what we call social media, makes the planet Earth into a global theater. We all perform for one another, and we all cannot catch all the performances that happen, let alone think about the significance of many of them, what they mean either to the people posting that content or the thousands of people who read one tweet or a series of tweets, or just what it means in the world. So each of these chapters is really personal for each of the contributors. It's these chapters and these hashtags are how each author experiences the global theater of social media. And they are able to explain, you know, really delve into and analyze the many layers of meaning of each of these very unique hashtag campaigns. So I just love how many different slices and perspectives we're able to get from this, what seems like an ungraspable, unrepresentable, you know, nearly unanalyzable phenomenon like Twitter.
And I mean, that's one of the things that makes this book really valuable and really useful for many scholars in many different fields, as you both noted. You know, it brings together a host of different disciplinary viewpoints and perspectives and frameworks to think about this idea, not only of identity, but all of the ways that identity is performed, is understood, particularly in the realm of social media. I really enjoyed reading this book, and I appreciate you sharing it with me. I wanted to know what each of you are working on now in terms of your research, if there's more coming out of this working group. And also, besides the University of Michigan Press, where can somebody pick up a copy of this book? Perhaps a brick and mortar store someplace, maybe in Berkeley, California?
So the Color of New Media Working Group is alive and well. And Gail and I are actually about to have a conversation about our plans for 2019-2020. Keep your eyes peeled for that. It's been sort of 5 years of work together, and it's been really quite exciting to see graduate students move through the working group as a kind of a place to begin to kickstart their careers. And so part of what I know I'm excited about the next steps in the working group is really to see where graduate students are at. What are the burning questions that are sort of animating their work, and how can an engagement with kind of minoritarian discourses and communities become articulated to that? So there's that. I will also say, just about where to get the book. One of the things that was really important to us was not only to be able to get the book at a brick and mortar store and at a reasonable price, all things considered. You know, University of Michigan Press was really kind to us to have a sort of a modestly priced paperback edition of the book. But we've also worked hard and got some support from the University of California Library System to have an open access edition of the book that will be free and available online. So when that's available, it's not quite out in the world as far as I understand.
It is. Yes,
oh, terrific.
I just checked today, and if anyone listening to this goes to the University of Michigan Press website and searches for hashtag identity, you will find an open access version of the book available.
Oh, fantastic.
And I will put that also in the blurb that goes with the New Books Network airing of the podcast. So people will be able to link to it that way too.
There's actually two versions available on the University of Michigan Press website. You could download it as an EPUB or you could download it as a PDF.
So I want to thank Abigail DeKosnick and Keith Feldman, who are the editors of hashtag identity, hashtagging race, gender, sexuality, and nation, published in 2019, University of Michigan Press, also available, open access. Thank you, Gail and Keith, for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Lily.